She was listening to him with an eager, incredulous smile. "It's so startling to hear," she said, "because it's so right.
What else can one think?"
She chuckled softly. "You know, when I was a child, I expected every businessman to think it.
And since then?"
"Since then, I've learned not to expect it."
"But it's right, isn't it?"
"I've learned not to expect the right."
"But it stands to reason, doesn't it?"
"I've given up expecting reason."
"That's what one must never give up," said Ken Daneker.
They had returned to the car and had started down the last descending curves of the road when she glanced at Galt, and he turned to her at once as if he had expected it. "It was you in Daneker's office that day, wasn't it?" she asked.
"Yes."
"Did you know then that I was waiting outside?"
"Yes."
"Did you know what it was like to wait behind that closed door?" She could not name the nature of the glance with which he looked at her. It was not pity, because she did not seem to be its object. It was the kind of glance with which one looks at suffering. But it was not her suffering that he seemed to be seeing.
"Oh, yes," he answered quietly,
almost lightly. The first shop to rise by the side of the valley's single street was like the sudden sight of an open theater, a frame box without front wall, its stage set in the bright colors of a musical comedy, with red cubes, green circles, gold triangles, which were bins of tomatoes, barrels of lettuce, pyramids of oranges, and a spangled backdrop where the sun hit shelves of metal containers. The name on the marquee said, "Hammond Grocery Market." A distinguished man in shirt sleeves with a stern profile and gray temples was weighing a chunk of butter for an attractive young woman who stood at the counter, her posture light as a showgirl's, the skirt of her cotton dress swelling faintly in the wind like a dance costume. Dagny smiled involuntarily, even though the man was Lawrence Hammond. The shops were small one-story structures, and as they moved past her, she caught familiar names on their signs, like headings on the pages of a book riffled by the car's motion. Mulligan General Store, Atwood Leather Goods, Nielsen Lumber. Then the sign of the dollar, above the door of a small brick factory with the inscription, "Mulligan Tobacco Company." "Who's the company besides Midas Mulligan?" she asked.
"Dr. Axton," he answered.
There were few passers-by, some men, fewer women, and they walked with purposeful swiftness, as if bound on specific errands. One after another, they stopped at the side of the car, they waved to Galt, and they looked at her with the unastonished curiosity of recognition. "Have I been expected here for a long time?" she asked.
"You still are," he answered.
On the edge of the road, she saw a structure made of glass sheets held together by a wooden framework. But for one instant, it seemed to her that it was only a frame for the painting of a woman, a tall, fragile woman with pale blonde hair, and a face of such beauty that it seemed veiled by distance, as if the artist had been merely able to suggest it, not to make it quite real. In the next instant, the woman moved her head, and Dagny realized that there were people at the tables inside the structure, that it was a cafeteria, that the woman stood behind the counter, and that she was Kay Ludlow, the movie star, who once seen could never be forgotten. The star who had retired and vanished 5 years ago to be replaced by girls of indistinguishable names and interchangeable faces. But at the shock of the realization, Dagny thought of the sort of movies that were now being made, and then she felt that the glass cafeteria was a cleaner use for Kay Ludlow's beauty than a role in a picture glorifying the commonplace for possessing no glory. The building that came next was a small, squat block of rough granite, sturdy, solid, neatly built, the lines of its rectangular bulk as severely precise as the creases of a formal garment. But she saw, like an instant's ghost, the long streak of a skyscraper rising into the coils of Chicago's fog. The skyscraper that had once borne the sign she now saw written in gold letters above a modest pinewood door. Mulligan Bank. Galt slowed the car while moving past the bank, as if placing the motion in some special italics. A small brick structure came next, bearing the sign, "Mulligan Mint." "A mint?" she asked. "What's Mulligan doing with a mint?" Galt reached into his pocket and dropped two small coins into the palm of her hand.
They were miniature discs of shining gold, smaller than pennies, the kind that had not been in circulation since the days of Nat Taggart. They bore the head of the Statue of Liberty on one side, the words, United States of America, $1, on the other. But the dates stamped upon them were of the past 2 years. "That's the money we use here," he said. "It's minted by Midas Mulligan."
"But on whose authority?"
"That's stated on the coin, on both sides of it."
"What do you use for small change?"
"Mulligan mints that, too, in silver. We don't accept any other currency in this valley. We accept nothing but objective values."
She was studying the coins. "This looks like something from the first morning in the age of my ancestors."
He pointed at the valley. "Yes, doesn't it?" She sat looking at the two thin, delicate, almost weightless drops of gold in the palm of her hand, knowing that the whole of the Taggart transcontinental system had rested upon them, that this had been the keystone supporting all the keystones, all the arches, all the girders of the Taggart track, the Taggart bridge, the Taggart building. She shook her head and slipped the coins back into his hand.
"You're not making it easier for me," she said, her voice low.
"I'm making it as hard as possible."
"Why don't you say it? Why don't you tell me all the things you want me to learn?"
The gesture of his arm pointed at the town, at the road behind them. "What have I been doing?" he asked. They drove on in silence. After a while, she asked, in the tone of a dryly statistical inquiry, "How much of a fortune has Midas Mulligan amassed in this valley?"
He pointed ahead.
"Judge for yourself." The road was winding through stretches of unleveled soil toward the homes of the valley. The homes were not lined along a street. They were spread at irregular intervals over the rises and hollows of the ground. They were small and simple, built of local materials, mostly of granite and pine, with a prodigal ingenuity of thought and a tight economy of physical effort. Every house looked as if it had been put up by the labor of one man. No two houses were alike, and the only quality they had in common was the stamp of a mind grasping a problem and solving it. Galt pointed out a house once in a while, choosing the names she knew, and it sounded to her like a list of quotations from the richest stock exchange in the world, or like a roll call of honor. Ken Daniger, Ted Nielsen, Lawrence Hammond, Roger Marsh, Ellis Wyatt, Owen Kellogg, Dr. Axton. The home of Dr. Axton was the last. A small cottage with a large terrace lifted on the crest of a wave against the rising walls of the mountains. The road went past it and climbed on into the coils of an ascending grade. The pavement shrank to a narrow path between two walls of ancient pines, their tall straight trunks pressing against it like a grim colonnade, their branches meeting above, swallowing the path into sudden silence and twilight. There were no marks of wheels on the thin strip of earth. It looked unused and forgotten. A few minutes and a few turns seemed to take the car miles away from human habitation. And then there was nothing to break the pressure of the stillness but a rare wedge of sunlight cutting across the trunks in the depth of the forest once in a while. The sudden sight of a house on the edge of the path struck her like the shock of an unexpected sound. Built in loneliness, cut off from all ties to human existence, it looked like the secret retreat of some great defiance or sorrow. It was the humblest home of the valley, a log cabin, beaten in dark streaks by the tears of many rains, only its great windows withstanding the storms with the smooth, shining, untouched serenity of glass.
"Whose houses?"
"Oh." She caught her breath and jerked her head away. Above the door, hit by a ray of sun, its design blurred and worn, battered smooth by the winds of centuries, hung the silver coat of arms of Sebastian d'Anconia. As if in deliberate answer to her involuntary movement of escape, Galt stopped the car in front of the house. For a moment they held each other's eyes. Her glance was a question, his a command. Her face had a defiant frankness, his an unrevealing severity. She understood his purpose, but not his motive. She obeyed. Leaning on her cane, she stepped out of the car, then stood erect, facing the house. She looked at the silver crest that had come from a marble palace in Spain to a shack in the Andes to a log cabin in Colorado, the crest of the men who would not submit. The door of the cabin was locked. The sun did not reach into the glazed darkness beyond the windows, and pine branches hung outstretched above the roof like arms spread in protection, in compassion, in solemn blessing. With no sound but the snap of a twig, or the ring of a drop falling somewhere in the forest, through long stretches of moments, the silence seemed to hold all the pain that had been hidden here, but never given voice. She stood listening with a gentle, resigned, unlamenting respect. Let's see who'll do greater honor, you to Nat Taggart, or I to Sebastian D'Anconia. Dagny, help me to remain, to refuse, even though he's right.